17 seconds in counting. Guidance internal. 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. Engines on. 5, 4, 3, 2. All engines on.
Listening to Cosmic Perspective. I'm your host, Andy Paneros. Today's guests are Dr. Pauline Schwartz and Dr. Carl Barrett, professors in the Tagliatelle School of Engineering at the University of New Haven. Our topic of discussion, the origins of life on Earth and elsewhere in the universe. Dr. Barrett and Dr. Schwartz are here to discuss their research in the field of prebiotic chemistry, known to many as the primordial soup of life, and how their findings may have given them the clues to the signature of all life in the universe. Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Barrett, thanks for joining us on Cosmic Perspective.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Dr. Schwartz, you're a chemistry professor, and Dr. Barrett, you're a professor of mechanical engineering. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about your background in your respective fields and how these very different backgrounds have brought you together to perform research on the origins of life on Earth?
Yes, well, thank you. My background, as you mentioned, is in chemistry. I have a pretty good interest in biology. I teach chemistry. I teach medicinal chemistry and pharmacology. I teach organic chemistry. And when I came to University of New Haven some 10 years ago, I wanted to start a research project that would involve students and began to look at ideas involving theoretical chemistry, particularly computational chemistry. And this was an area that certainly did involve some of my background in chemistry and biology, but clearly there was a lot of math and even indeed physics involved. And I chatted quite a bit with my colleague, Dr. Carl Barrett, who has a fantastic background and expertise in those areas. And that's how we sort of got together.
Yeah. And truth of advertising, my background has got nothing to do with biology or chemistry. Many years ago, in a previous century, when I was doing my PhD at the Cavendish Laboratory, Cambridge, I was actually working in what I would call pre-superstring theory, theoretical high-energy physics, dual resonance models, the precursor of superstring theory. And I knew from a very early age that I wanted to be a physicist, and certainly when I was at the equivalent of high school in England, what we call grammar school, I decided that I did want to pursue pure physics and mathematics, and so I promptly dropped chemistry after my A-levels, and I went to Bristol University to study just mathematics and physics. And then I taught physics in a few institutions on both sides of the Atlantic, and then I became a mechanical engineer, long story, which we won't go into. I'm a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of New Haven. Still no biology or chemistry in my background, at least not until Pauline called me to her office one day and said, "What do you know about Pirando paradox?" And I said, "Nothing." And it was a mathematical paradox, but I have this condition, which I call easily distracted by interesting problems. So long story short, one thing led to another, and from Pirando paradox, I got into chemical kinetics, and at least the mathematical aspect of them, and for the last few years, we've been moving on from Pirondo paradox to study chiral symmetry breaking. Again, I look at the more mathematical aspects of it. And Pauline, of course, is the expert in chemistry and biology. And we've formed quite a synergetic group with the help of some very bright students. We produce some pretty nice papers. And that's what brings us here today to talk about prebiotic chemistry.
Dr. Barrett, being easily distracted certainly has had a positive effect on your research in prebiotic chemistry.
Well, I'm always looking out for a new problem to work on. Rather than spending my entire life working on, say, superstring theory, which I would probably not make too much progress in, I'm easily distracted to work on a bunch of problems. And nonlinear systems, that itself leads to a whole bunch of problems. You know, chaos theory, I've worked in that for several years. And in a way, the fates were directing me to do that because they were anticipating Pauline needing me to help her out in my whatever way I could with the prebiotic, because the models we work with are nonlinear. Mathematical models, of course, we look at them using computational software as well as the mathematical approach. And my work in chaotic dynamics, which is basically the dynamics of the universe, is all good training. So it's a natural convergence.
Earlier in our discussion, you mentioned Pirondo's paradox. Can you tell us a little bit about Pirondo's paradox and how it's helped you in your research?
When I came to the University of New Haven some 10 years ago, I looked into my collection of previous articles that I had read and ideas I had, and there was an interesting article there on a mathematical concept called Pirondo's paradox. It has nothing to do with chemistry. It's totally mathematical. But it gave us some idea of something to try. And just to tell you a little bit about Pirondo's paradox. What that says is certain types of games, and these are mathematical games, not the typical games you might know, but if you had game A and game B, they might be losing games or set up to be losing games. But if you then played game A and then B and then A and then B, or played them back and forth or in some other type of pattern, all of a sudden, very surprisingly, you would be winning instead of losing. Now, that seems paradoxical until you really look at the math. And then when you look at the math, it becomes rather obvious that, in fact, that really indeed does happen. Well, this was mathematical, and we wanted to take that to a different level. Could we use that to explore novel chemistry? And so instead of game A and game B, this became reaction A and reaction B. And instead of giving you, maybe they would both make a product called C. But if you did something different, maybe you'd make a different product. And it took us a while to figure this out. What would we try? And it worked out to be temperature. If we could take the temperature, instead of going between the games, we switched the temperatures between A and B. Low temperature, high temperature, low temperature, high temperature, something totally different happened. And there it was, a very interesting paradox that was moved into the area of chemistry. But we wanted to see that that was not just something that we could do on our computers and with our computational systems. And we wanted to show this to Dr. Barrett and see if he could validate our model and learn a little bit of math along the way. And so we sort of had him intrigued by this idea, and we had a number of really good students working on this. So that's how we started.
When I think of research in chemistry, I think of flames, beakers, mixing of chemicals, but this is all done mathematically and by computers. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And you've been able to use this paradox to help you in your research.
Well, that's exactly right. It really is research in that we had a hypothesis. We tested our hypothesis using computers, and it wasn't so easy. At the beginning, the answer wasn't what we expected, and we tried, again, using computers with different parameters until we found something that was indeed something interesting to us that sort of fit into the framework of the Pirondo's paradox. And again, we were able to ask Dr. Barrett to mathematically confirm that, and he was able to do so, and we were able to get our first paper.
One has to realize that what software does is it ultimately is taking things called differential equations, which govern the dynamics of a system, and it turns it into some code, call it Runge-Kutta method and so on. Me being the physicist, the mathematician, cynical about software, not trusting it, I would rather work directly with the differential equations and try to solve them. Unfortunately, the sort of equations we're working with are nonlinear, which means they're pretty much insoluble, except in certain regions of parameter space, in certain limits, I was able to make some progress in solving them. And the bottom line is that my solution seemed to agree with what the software was giving, which increased my confidence that the software was doing it right. If two different people using two different methods get the same answer, then maybe we're onto something. So while Pauline doesn't necessarily need my highfalutin mathematics, because the software will basically do it and produce pretty plots and so on, I derive some sort of masochistic pleasure out of struggling for weeks or months on end trying to solve the equations. And our papers have a bit of math and a bit of computation and biology, and it is sort of very interdisciplinary.
Sort of a check and balance.
Check and balance, absolutely. If we both got the same answer, we were either both wrong or we're both right.
And that's an important aspect of science. We all know that lots of ideas that our ancestors had, that the world was flat, for example, no longer true, because we start to look out and the world does look flat to us, but we have new evidence. And what science does is provide evidence and provides those types of things that people verify. They verify a hypothesis until it's well understood how something works. And that's what science does. Science dispels some kind of myth and then moves on to look at more of how we understand nature in a very different way.
And unfortunately, we no longer get into trouble with the church for saying that the earth is not flat and that the earth goes around the sun rather than the sun going around the earth and so on, which is a sort of relief to me. I'm not going to have to look forward to house arrest like Galileo did.
Fortunately, we live in a time where we can express our opinions. And yes. I always love this thing where I read in the newspaper, scientists go back to the drawing board. Scientists start over again. We continue to keep learning and learning and finding out more. And as you said, Dr. Barrett, you know, you could both be wrong or you could both be right. And that's the part of science that that's important that we need to
It's unfortunate that sometimes when one makes a brilliant experimental discovery that it does send all of the theorists back to the drawing board. But ultimately, we're searching for the truth, right? So we've got to put up with the pain.
Exactly. This is Cosmic Perspective. Today, my guests are Dr. Carl Barrett and Dr. Pauline Schwartz. We've been discussing the computational and mathematical research that they're performing on the origins of life on Earth in the Tagliatella School of Engineering at the University of New Haven. When we return, we're going back in time about 4 billion years when life was forming on the Earth and discuss how Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Barrett's unexpected findings through their further research in prebiotic chemistry may have given them the clues to the signatures of life on Earth and maybe elsewhere in the universe. Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Barrett, your research using Perrondo's paradox brought you to another area of research.
Well, we were very lucky that our collaboration on our initial paper, which involved Perrondo's paradox, sort of moved beyond that, and we began to look at an area called prebiotic chemistry. And prebiotic chemistry, as you noted earlier, is the chemistry that occurred on the early Earth some 4 billion years ago before there was any life. We know that there was lots of time and lots of different small molecules, lots of water. There was no oxygen, by the way, at least not free oxygen in the air, in the atmosphere. And we have looked, again, using our computational models to ask now some questions about computational systems and how they might have give us some idea of the types of chemistry that might have happened under those conditions and that may give us some clues as to some very important and unanswered questions in an area called astrobiology.
When you performed these experiments and you did all this computational work, you found something that was unexpected?
Yes, indeed. Yes. Again, because they are sort of nonlinear systems, you generally can't just look at them and sort of say, oh, I expect this or that to happen. Sometimes you really have to try them out and see what they tell you. And the question that we were interested in that really still doesn't have a well-established answer is, how did the building blocks of the important molecules that we need for life, things like proteins and RNA and DNA, how did those proteins become what is called homochiral? Now, the word chiral means handedness, literally like left-handed and right-handed. And if you go into the laboratory and make any of those molecules, indeed, you make an equal amount of left and right-handed forms. But it seems that all life on Earth, whether it's us, whether it's dogs, trees, bacteria, whether it was any form of life that we know on Earth, they all use L amino acids, they all use D sugars, and no one seems to understand how that might have happened. Now, we certainly know that meteorites might have brought some of these molecules to Earth, but they also brought, again, both left and right-handed forms, maybe with a little bit of a predominance of one over the other, but not a great number. And we went to our computational models to see if we could come up with a system that would separate these molecules in much greater amounts. And we did indeed find a very interesting system, which what they say breaks chiral symmetry. And when that happened, a system that appeared to be stable, all of a sudden, for reasons that, again, depend more on the math, all of a sudden did break symmetry, and one form became a much higher concentration, and the other one became a lower concentration. We think that's a random event, and so we think we're L amino acids here on Earth only because randomly that's how it happened. We could easily be, or D amino acids. And certainly if we look elsewhere, we're bound to need this idea of breaking symmetry. We need homochiral building blocks to make polymers that carry information, that are important in replication. They need to be homochiral. And so we think this idea of breaking symmetry might be what they call a signature of life, not only here on Earth, but maybe throughout our universe. And so we think we have a little bit of math and a little bit of a computational system that predicts how that might have happened. And again, we were very happy to collaborate with Dr. Barrett to see if he could validate those models.
So the early primordial soup was basically in a state, in a metastable state of precarious balance, sort of like trying to balance a broomstick on your hand. You know, you have to move your hand a bit and so on. It just wants to tip over. And the smallest perturbation, we'll call it the butterfly effect. Anybody who's read Gleick's best-selling book on chaos knows about the butterfly effect, that a butterfly can flap its wings in Beijing and cause a tsunami in Connecticut and something. And somehow in this primordial soup, along came a butterfly, not literally, but some sort of imbalance, some perturbation which knocked the system, just like the broomstick, just a little bit. And then the dynamics of the system, and this comes through in the equations that we work with, you know, this metastable state, it just spirals off exponentially to this other state in which the broom has basically fallen over. It's fallen either to the left or the right. It fell over to the left, and that's why all the amino acids are left-handed and all the sugars are right-handed. And if it, as Pauline said, if it wasn't like that, you know, if it was still 50-50, then we'd probably look pretty weird, and we wouldn't have evolved and been intelligent beings that we are, and so on, I suppose.
I think another piece to this is the sources of energy that might have been involved. It's not just the chemicals, but the right conditions of temperature and the like, but also the fact that, you know, on the early Earth, we had volcanoes and we had both high temperatures and low temperatures at different times. The hydrothermal vents were another place where we had very high temperatures and the like. But we had lightning on the early Earth. We had impacts that even the impact itself was a source of energy. So there's many types of energy that would have interacted with the chemical systems to cause the types of reactions that take place to make larger and larger molecules. And then those larger molecules would have been the precursors that would have made proteins and RNA and DNA and continued on and evolved in such that we have the life that we have here on Earth.
Dr. Schwartz, when you talk about this breaking of symmetry of amino acids possibly being the signature of life and the role that energy plays, I can't help but think about Saturn's moon Titan. NASA's Cassini mission to Saturn has primarily studied Titan for the past 10 years. Scientists believe that Titan is very much like the Earth was in its infancy. It has an atmosphere consisting primarily of nitrogen. I believe the Earth's early atmosphere was also mostly nitrogen.
That's correct.
They found these hydrocarbons of ethane and methane lakes. It seasonally rains there, and dried hydrocarbons on the surface. Is it possible on a place like Titan that this tip and balance could happen? There are hydrocarbons there. There are building blocks of life. Is it possible that in a cold place like that, that we could find there to be this tip and balance and that we might find someday microbial life there?
I think it is indeed possible. Again, the chemistry of Titan is considerably different in that the principal material there is liquid ammonia. We have a sort of a prejudice, if you will, that we think water would be really required for life, but we've learned that life can survive in very extreme environments, even here on the Earth. But we've always sort of looked for water. We've looked for carbon because we know that's an element that really can support the kind of diverse life and molecules that are needed for life. But it could very well be something different. I think carbon is probably going to be a winner, but possibly liquid methane or liquid ammonia. But we do know that, in fact, Enceladus appears to have liquid water, quite a lot of it. Maybe we go deep down there, where we'll find something interesting.
But one thing I can guarantee, I can't guarantee too much about Titan, except that it's probably a pretty hostile environment to live in, so I'm not going to go there. But one thing I can guarantee is that the four forces of nature, gravity, the weak and electromagnetic, the strong nuclear force, and the weak nuclear force, which governs radioactivity, those are going to exist on Titan. And I'm confident that there are butterflies out there in the universe. They've been there from the get-go. A very famous experiment done back in 1957, I think, by C.S. Wu at Columbia, demonstrated that the weak nuclear current, one of the four forces of nature, the weak nuclear force, violates parity. There's a slight imbalance, which could lead to a slight imbalance in the energy of left and right-handed electrons. There's a butterfly. The background radiation is polarized at a very small, minuscule level. So I'm confident that the tiny effect needed to tip the scales, as it were, is been with us from the get-go. The creator put that in the Big Bang, let's say, and so on. So, and then you've got the building blocks, you've got the dynamics, the nonlinear dynamics. I think no matter where you are in our universe, and probably in parallel universes, well, certainly in our galaxy, I think I'm pretty confident that the ingredients are there to have some sort of life on many planetary systems within our own galaxy, let alone within the 100 billion galaxies in our universe. And who knows what happens in all those parallel universes as well.
I think these are very exciting times. We now know that in our own backyard in the solar system that there are geysers coming out of Enceladus of salt water.
Mm-hmm.
We also know that Titan has these hydrocarbon lakes of ethane and methane, and it also may have an underlying ocean of water. Saturn's rings are 99.some-odd% water ice. We've studied faraway galaxies and found sugars, the building blocks, this primordial soup that we've been talking about. That's very exciting, that the possibility of this slight tip in I'm not sure how you said it, but a tip of
the small nature? Perturbation needed to tip the balance and ultimately end up with a chirality. Maybe on Titan there'll be right-handed amino acids. Who knows? But can't make any guarantees that way. But
There's an interesting paper that just came out from MIT saying that if you have the right conditions, that both kinetically and thermodynamically, life is inevitable. That may be difficult for some people to understand and appreciate, but I think it's going to be shown to be true someday, that if you have the right conditions, life indeed is inevitable. The fellow from MIT, a fellow by the name of English, went on to show theoretically that if you have those right conditions and you have energy, that you're likely to have replicating systems.
I think what's fascinating about the subject is that the more we search, whether it be from computational research, ground-based telescopes, or space missions that study the solar system and the far reaches of the universe, the more evidence we find that life may be abundant in the universe. My guests on Cosmic Perspective today are Dr. Pauline Schwartz and Dr. Carl Barrett from the University of New Haven. We've been discussing how life may have formed on the Earth and the possibility of life elsewhere in the universe. Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Barrett, I'd like to discuss our genetic code, our DNA. I understand that our DNA is only about 1% different than the DNA of a chimpanzee, and we're not any different than
a flower, a bug.
No, that's exactly right. We all share that genetic code because we all probably share that very origin, that very single cell that started all life on Earth. That's our ancestor, some 4 billion years ago, the ancestor of all life on Earth. Now, there may have been many, many other starts, but they did not succeed. And that one cell gave us the many branches of life that we have, bacteria and archaea and the eukaryotes that became us, of course. But we all started, there's pretty darn good evidence that we started from a single cell long, you know, billions of years ago.
Our universe is primarily hydrogen and helium, and the small percentage that's left over is the dust of exploded stars. Other than hydrogen is pretty much what we're made of. When you say that there are many other starts that the single cell from this primordial soup recipe that didn't succeed, what could have stopped them from succeeding? Could it have been this tip and balance that wasn't there?
Or it could have been that the conditions were such that temperatures were too hot or too cold for the chemical reactions to take place. We know, for example, that even our moon doesn't have very much of an atmosphere because it doesn't have very much gravity. Right. So there's lots of conditions that might be important for having life in any form that does indeed replicate and does indeed evolve. But it's clear that if you have those right conditions, that there's nothing chemically that will stop that from happening.
And looking really big picture, I mean, there's a lot of talk recently about dark energy, the energy that is basically pushing our universe apart. Actually, we're not slowing down in our expansion, we're actually accelerating, and this is caused by dark energy. It's almost like a negative gravity, a repulsive gravity. And if that was just a little bit stronger, if the negative gravity was just a little bit stronger, matter would never have congealed to form these building blocks. And if the dark energy level was just a tad smaller, the stars may have all gone to black holes and never exploded to produce the garbage that is us, the bigger elements and so on that we're made of. So there's a really fine balance at the biggest of all scales, the dark energy scale. We have 100 billion galaxies within our universe. And of course, there's 100 billion stars within our galaxy. The chances are pretty good that there's some sort of life out there.
Yeah, and I think we're finding, this is really a very wonderful idea, that many, many of our stars have planets, that many of those planets are in what we again call a habitable zone. Maybe we'll learn to extend that a bit, but right now we're seeing that there are plenty of possible planets that might in fact harbor at one time or another, might have harbored life.
This also makes me kind of think that someday the sun, our star, special star, will swell and it will start to run out of fuel and become a red giant to the point where the Earth's orbit will be inside of it.
Well, it will be incinerated. It'll get hot.
It'll get
hot. It'll make climate change look like a Hawaii.
It'll be a very warm night, isn't it?
Yes, indeed.
5 billion years' time that's going to happen. It's going to go through the red giant stage. It's going to explode in a supernova, more garbage coming out, more planetary systems. Our star, it will, in death, it will become a white dwarf. It won't ever get to the neutron or black hole stage. It's just not massive enough. But it's the cycle of stellar evolution.
So my thought was, when the sun becomes a red giant and swells,
in the evolution of our own solar system, would it be possible that the outer planets and their moons become habitable in, yeah, or in the habitable
zone?
It's
a good idea. I don't know what the time scale of the red giant stage is. You know, it might be over and done within a mere few 100,000 or a million years and so on, but it's a very good idea. Right now, the planets that are frozen snowballs, yeah, they'll be quite nice. I think maybe we should go visit them.
Buy real estate or something.
We may have to, of course. You know, the way we're going, I think we'd better move outward. Yeah, we're going to land on Mars, and then we should move on to, well, Jupiter's a bit too hostile, I think.
But I suspect so. But
maybe Titan. Titan, Pauline.
But it should be
I'm looking at Europa myself.
Europa,
the cucumber. Cool as a cucumber right at the moment, yeah.
I think we'd be able to hang around Mars for about 500 million years before things changed, and then we had to go further out.
Maybe. Uh-huh. Maybe that long. Yeah. Not within our lifetime.
Dr. Barrett and Dr. Schwartz, thanks for being with us on Cosmic Perspective and this wonderful conversation on the chemical evolution of life on Earth and elsewhere in the universe. Dr. Pauline Schwartz and Dr. Carl Barrett are professors in the Tagliatella School of Engineering at the University of New Haven. If our listeners are interested in pursuing a career in prebiotic chemistry, or if they have any questions for Dr. Schwartz or Dr. Barrett, do you have an email address or contact information?
Yes, we both have websites. And again, if you go to the University of New Haven and look up our names, you'll see our the papers we've written and something about our research interests and what we do at the University of New Haven. Also, some of the students that have been involved in our research. We emphasize experiential education in a very big way there, and so we really do want to get students involved in our research. But if there's others, people who have questions or want to know a little bit more about what we do, that's a great way to contact us. We have an email there and a phone number, all the obvious stuff.
Astrobiology and prebiotic chemistry in our own backyards at the University of New Haven. Dr. Schwartz and Dr. Barrett, thanks again for being with us today and giving us a cosmic perspective on the origins of life.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Great to be here.
Cosmic Perspective is an Andy Paneros production.